From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Callum Borchers. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, Wynn Resorts is in talks to sell Encore Boston Harbor to MGM.
It's not a good look for MGM to be talking about buying a casino that's valued right now at $2.6 billion when they're laying off people left and right around the country.
We'll talk to Everett Mayor Carlo DiMaria. Also today, the debate over Senator Bernie Sanders' proposal to expand Medicare to cover all Americans.
Healthcare is a human right, not a privilege. And the best way to go forward, in my view, is through a Medicare for All single-payer program.
One expert says that's the wrong approach. And how should the NFL deal with Patriots owner Robert Kraft?
If you do nothing, then you're showing a double standard for players versus owners. You're also in a time of sensitivity toward treatment of women. You're presenting as somewhat tone deaf.
That's all next on WBUR's Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Callum Borchers. A month from opening its $2.6 billion Everett Casino, Wynn Resorts might have been down to the final details, making sure the light hits those hand-assembled Murano glass chandeliers just right. Instead, the company has something much bigger on its to-do list, deciding whether it wants to keep the casino at all. Wynn said Friday that it's in preliminary talks about selling the Encore Boston Harbor Casino to MGM Resorts, which just opened a casino of its own in Springfield. And this comes after Wynn Resorts fought hard to keep its casino license, as state regulators ripped the company for its handling of sexual misconduct allegations against former CEO Steve Wynn. On the line to discuss all these developments is Everett Mayor Carlo DiMaria. Mayor DiMaria, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks, Cal.
Glad to have you. We're basically just wondering what everybody's wondering. What was your first reaction to this news on Friday? Were you surprised or did you have some notice?
No, definitely surprised. We had heard rumblings, you know, thought it was just more, you know, rumors, or, you know, but when it came out and then I was confirmed the conversation with the CEO himself, shocked, disappointed. Disappointed that they would want to do this.
I would imagine that you weren't surprised that they had begun these talks before the Gaming Commission issued its decision saying they could keep the license, right? I mean, we had seen reports last year that they had been in talks about a possible sale to MGM. But are you surprised the talks continue now that they do have the license in hand and have permission to proceed, that they're still considering a sale?
You know, I think, you know, just myself, I'm probably thinking the CEO, Mr. Maddox, is probably somewhat disappointed with some of the language that was in the report from the Gaming Commission. They really basically called him an unfit CEO in some fashion or form.
And the commissioners were split about whether he was still fit to keep. And the commissioners were split about whether he was fit to keep the job as well. So you're right about that.
Right. And I know that having a monitor in the corporate offices is something that is not something that they want to see. I believe the CEO feels that way. That, you know, that's something that he doesn't want to have. But that's why I really think there's got to be a conversation with the city of Everett, with Mr. Maddox, and with the Gaming Commission to resolve some of these issues. Right?
Have you had that conversation? Have you talked to Matt Maddox or company executives since Friday?
You know, I've had a conversation with Matt Maddox, but not to that point saying we should call a meeting with the Gaming Commission. I did send in a letter into the, or we will be sending a letter into the Gaming Commission to try to have that conversation because, you know, we're not going to budge. We're not going to allow another resort to buy this facility. Especially if they're not a five-star resort like Wynn is, a company that can really draw an international clientele, really create that destination resort feel, right? That's what was kind of portrayed to us, you know, by the CEO and founder himself. We did lots of telephone town halls with our residents, lots of public meetings with our residents. We talked about transforming not just the Monsanto site, which has been a great feat in itself, right, a Superfund site that's been contaminated for decades and now restored and, you know, beautiful access to the waterfront. But we talked about Civil Line Extension, commuter rail stops. Wynn has acquired over $100 million worth of ancillary parcels in and around the resort, right? There's always been we've always had those conversations, expectations that they would build more hotel rooms, that they would bring, again, the Civil Line over the commuter rail line, build a pedestrian footbridge connecting over to the Orange Line, which we're not connected to. You know, all those things go away, right? This company, you know, they bought into our, we did a Lower Broadway master plan exercise back in 2010, and they saw that, you know, years later after their attempt to open a casino in Foxborough fell through, and they said, you know what, we love it, we want to do it, we want to not just build a one resort, but we want to build more, you know. So for me, just to have a casino operating in my community, that wasn't my intention and my goal.
It was specifically Wynn, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, but my intention was to build this, you know, this district, right?
But I guess part of what I'm wondering, though, is, and if you'll pardon the gambling pun, but what cards do you hold here? I mean, what can you do to actually stop the sale if they actually want to go through and sell this property? I realize you've got a local provision in your host agreement, but are you worried that with their team of lawyers they could find a way to get around it?
I feel confident with the team of lawyers that I have on our end and the assurances that were given to me already that Section 10 specifically spells out that both parties have to agree on a transfer of sale. And we also are, you know, we haven't finalized our 121A. It's the way we get paid. We're making some changes to that document now that it's not just Wynn LLC Boston. It's with the parent company. So any transfer or sale of this facility has to be approved by both the City of Everett and Wynn in Las Vegas. So it's not just, you know, they get around it by selling Wynn LLC Boston, right? So we're tightening up our language now in our 121A that still has not been signed. So, you know, I feel we have our own cards, you know, and I'm sorry, I just I don't really know much about MGM, but again, they're already operating, you know, in Springfield. Mayor Sano, a dear friend of mine who had made promises to his residents, they have about 3,800 employees down there. What happens to Springfield? What does that become? Who operates that?
You know, there's a big ripple effect. There's no question.
It's a big ripple effect. Yeah. And I don't care. You know, I care about not just my resort, but I care about the communities in and around all of Massachusetts, to be honest with you. And I care about Mayor Sano and his people in the 3,800 jobs there. And I care about the 5,800 jobs here. You know, do they take, does someone come in and promise to maintain the level of services that Wynn, you know, provides? You and I both know that's not the case. You know, you go to many resorts where they don't have as many employees. They don't go above and beyond like Wynn does, right?
And that's, yeah, and we've seen
again,
the reporting about
I would not have done a deal
the generous compensation. And right, yeah. In the moments we have left, Mr. Mayor, I'm wondering whether, you know, if you're able to get this sort of you know, convening of the commission and Matt Maddox, the Wynn CEO that you're talking about. I mean, can you, I don't know, sort of broker a deal here? I mean, we saw the Globe columnist Joan Vinaki today speculating that perhaps Maddox is making this personal. Of course, he got hit with a $500,000 fine and that he's really mad at the monitor that you described. I mean, maybe you could kind of play peacemaker and get this thing patched up?
Well, I think someone has to. I think someone has to do that to maintain the integrity of the game legislation that was passed, and I'm sure I'll have support from a lot of other elected officials. We have to. I mean, we can't, you just can't. This is the Region A license. You know, it was meant to go to a 5-star resort. I don't know many others like Wynn that can provide that level of service. Not saying that MGM can or cannot, right? But I know
but you had a bird in the hand, and it was a pretty good one, and you and you'd like to keep it.
yes, right. I mean, we had a partner in the, even the local group that has been assembled here. They're, you know, they're a real tremendous group of professionals. that get it, they're community oriented. They've supported so many of different community groups not only in Everett but in the Commonwealth itself. Right, this is a a 5-star resort that gets it. They understand that they want to provide the highest quality of services to their employees, to their residents, and to the people that are their customers. Right, and no one else is going to do that. And again, all the different amenities, the transportation amenities, the desire to build more rooms, the desire to really, the parcels they purchased, scrap yards, used car lots. It's been really like an industrial section of the city of Everett for years that they really, have a vision to transform. I don't believe anyone else will do that. So that's where we're at.
That's Everett Mayor Carlo DiMaria. Mr. Mayor, thanks a lot for being with us today.
Cal, no problem. Thank you.
All right, let's bring in WBUR State House reporter Steve Brown, who's been listening in to that conversation. Hey there, Steve.
Hey, Cal.
So we just heard Mayor DiMaria in Everett suggest that perhaps he could get everybody in a room, the Gaming Commission, the CEO of Wynn Resorts, Matt Maddox, figure something out here to make sure that we can move forward with Wynn continuing to own Encore Boston Harbor. From your read of covering this for a long time, does that seem like a possible scenario?
Well, that's kind of like herding cats, I think, it's going to be difficult to get everybody on the same page there because there's, so many things at play here. And I think he touched upon possibly some hard feelings on the part of Matt Maddox to the sanctions that were handed down by the Mass Gaming Commission some folks would some CEOs would find that insulting. And I'm sure he does. So can they get them all together and rowing in the same direction? That's a difficult task.
Well, so we mentioned the possible hurt feelings there. What else are you hearing, Steve, about why Wynn Resorts might be willing to entertain a bid for this thing that it just spent $2.5 million to build?
They're not feeling the love from Massachusetts, especially from the Gaming Commission, where the commission rebuked Matt Maddox, who was the CEO, and Steve Wynn's protege, the last real connection between the company of today and Steve Wynn, whose reputation has really just gone, personal reputation has gone down the dumper in the past year after everything that was revealed last year. Now, requiring him to have Matt Maddox get that management coaching, as I said, he probably considers that it's an insult. And I think last year when, knowing that the commission could do pretty much anything it wanted to punish them. The commission could have yanked the license away from Wynn altogether.
Sure.
And if that was the case, they were going to have to figure out how do we unload this property that we've dumped $2.5 billion in. So, I was hearing yesterday in the building, these rumors have been floating about. And as the mayor was just saying a few minutes ago to you, these rumors were going out. Well, I think Wynn likely wanted to, and if we're going with gambling expressions, they wanted to cover all their bets and develop an exit strategy if need be. If they lost the license, what are they going to do with that property? So they were probably getting their ducks in a row, lining up MGM. And, it turns out that the sanction was not as severe as saying, Wynn, no, you can't have this at all. They said, no, you're still suitable, but Matt Maddox, we don't like a lot of the things that you've been done, and we think you need this help, and we're going to fine you, and we're going to have somebody looking over your shoulder and all that. So what Maddox is probably doing now is he's going to the Wynn board and say, look, you got to pick either Boston or me. The fact is that Wynn Resorts makes most of their money from Asia. Their future really doesn't depend on Boston. And if Maddox expects that he's going to get nothing but headaches and hassles from state regulators, it makes a lot of sense to cut the losses and get out of Dodge.
So just from a logistical standpoint here, Steve, how the heck would Wynn and MGM untangle this mess? Because there's a lot of hurdles you got to jump over. You'd have to get sign-off from the Gaming Commission, which has been very busy doing fitness hearings and redoing fitness hearings. What would this process look like?
It's all uncharted territory. I mean, these are the first licenses to go out there, and we've only got one full casino operating and one slots parlor. There's still room for two more, one that's going to supposedly open next month and possibly one down in Region C, down in southeastern Massachusetts. So they really don't know exactly how this would play out. And, you know, I've tried to ask questions of the Gaming Commission. How about this? How about this hypothetical situation? They don't want to deal in hypothetical situations. They say they're only going to deal with things as they come to them. And they have to judge by the facts on the ground on that particular case. So they're not going with the what if type of games. You know, just looking at the law and looking at what the commission has to do. If this double switch where MGM takes over Everett and MGM gives up their Springfield property, it would probably, I think, be sort of a double swap where they would get everybody. You know, Wynn would say, okay, we're leaving. MGM's going to take over Everett. Company Z is going to come in and take over Springfield's property. Let's, you know, you guys, the commission now goes and determines the suitability of Company Z that's coming in. They're also going to reopen the suitability of MGM to see if they're still qualified to operate the property in Everett. And then it would all kind of move as one big shift. That's kind of speculation on our part as to how this would operate. But again, it's uncharted territory. We really don't know for sure.
Boy, we all knew it would be uncharted territory when that casino law was signed in 2011. But who knew that we would end up here when these things were finally opening? That's WBUR reporter.
Absolutely. Nothing is simple.
Nothing is simple. Steve Brown, thanks a lot for your time today.
Thanks, Cal.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Callum Borchers. This is Radio Boston.
Wait a second.
Don't hit the skip button.
I mean, we know you do it.
We just wanted to take a second here because you already know how to download a podcast.
But you might have a question about some of the other technology you use, and we think we can help.
WBUR is working on a new show, and we're here to answer your tech questions, whether it's hardware-related,
software-related, social, even ethical.
Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and give us a call. Leave a message, 617-917-4717.
Give it a try. 617-917-4717.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Callum Borchers. Senator Bernie Sanders is running for president again on a single-payer health care plan that he calls Medicare for All. Four of his primary opponents have said they support the plan. Senators Elizabeth Warren, Kamala Harris, Kirsten Gillibrand, and Cory Booker are all co-sponsors. But not all Democrats are on board. On Radio Boston this month, former Maryland Congressman John Delaney said Medicare for All would be a mistake.
I actually think that piece of legislation will make access to health care more limited and won't do anything to control health care costs and in many ways may reduce quality.
Next week, we'll speak with a physician who supports Medicare for All. But today we're talking with John Kingsdale. He's a professor at the Boston University School of Public Health and was the founding executive director of the Commonwealth Health Insurance Connector Authority, which helped make health insurance universally available in Massachusetts. Welcome to Radio Boston, John Kingsdale.
Good afternoon, Cal.
So you've written an op-ed for the Boston Globe called The Risks of Medicare for All. And I should note that Medicare for All can mean different things to different people, but you begin by referring to the Sanders plan, which would bar employers from offering their own private insurance plans. And you write that the idea is, quote, tantalizing, and yet you're wary of it. So why?
Well, I think at this particular time in our history, there are tremendous risks. I actually do not oppose Medicare for All in theory. In fact, if we could close our eyes and wake up in Canada tomorrow morning, that might be fine. The trick is how to get from here to there. And that essentially entails shifting half of the funding for America's largest economic segment. Sector, about 18% of GDP.
The whole healthcare sector.
The healthcare sector is about 1 in 6 of our gross domestic product. It's literally 1 in 8 jobs are in healthcare. It's bigger than manufacturing or retail as an employer. And shifting half of that funding from private to tax federal funding would cause actually pretty substantial disruption and in the context of the 2020 election, could have actually disastrous results.
So is it all about the disruption? Like, I'm curious if in a vacuum you were creating a country from scratch and designing the healthcare system, are you saying that a Medicare for all single payer style system would be better than the current system that we have, but that the problem is the transition? Or are you saying that actually Medicare for all isn't all it's cracked up to be regardless of the circumstances?
Well, there are certainly problems with Medicare for All. It has its own set of warts. But actually, close to a dozen countries have kind of started from scratch in the last several decades. And about half of them have decided Medicare, or a variant of that, is a good approach for them. So it has a lot of appeal. It's not synonymous. It's not the only way to get to universal coverage. I think a lot of Americans hear Medicare for All and they equate it with universal coverage. In fact, there's three or four different models that countries in Europe and in Asia have used to get to universal coverage. My main problem and my main fear at this point is one of a number of good ways to get there, but we have so far to go to get there now that it would be extremely disruptive. And to me, the 800-pound elephant in the room is what it would do to the Democratic prospects in the 2020 campaign. And I'm happy to elaborate on that, but in a sentence, it could turn what has been the number one policy advantage for Democrats, what really helped Democrats take back the House in 2018, into a huge political liability in 2020. And frankly, Republicans are salivating at the prospect of running in 2020 against Medicare for All.
You're saying that sort of saving Obamacare can be a great rallying cry for Democrats, but that if you go farther to what Republicans will call socialized medicine, that you then will hand them a real advantage.
That's exactly it. And I suspect some Republicans will call just preserving and enhancing the Affordable Care Act, or as you call it, Obamacare, socialized medicine. But they won't have much credibility, and they didn't in 2018, and that's easy to rebut. Rebutting that on the case of Medicare for All, which would take about $30 trillion of additional federal taxation to fund over the next decade, is much heavier lift politically, economically, and in terms of its impact on society.
All right. So you mentioned a number of countries that have recently gone to single-payer models. Is there a model that you particularly like? Or maybe it's a different way to universal health care that you were talking about. Maybe it's the Massachusetts model that you were part of implementing. If folks have forgotten, sometimes we call it Romney Care, right? But this was the 2006 law, which really hinged largely on that individual mandate, right? I mean, is that the way to go?
I think the individual mandate was a key piece. That there's some recent evidence that it wasn't as important as we initially thought. One of the remarkable things about the Affordable Care Act, which, as you say, Cal, was modeled on Massachusetts' attempt at health reform, is that even without the mandate, and that's really not in effect anymore as of 2019, the tax penalty has been zeroed out. Even without the mandate, it's actually proved fairly resistant. So it's been under attack and yet has been able to maintain – we've seen a little erosion in the last year or two, but has been able to maintain a pretty high rate of insurance where it's being implemented.
All right. So as I mentioned at the top, this is – the Medicare for All umbrella covers a lot of things, but the specific plan that has that title is a bill filed – or refiled, I should say, this year by Senator Bernie Sanders. And of course, he's been out on the campaign trail talking about the merits of it. And he was recently on CNN for a town hall style event where he said that there's a fundamental problem with the private insurance market that we have right now.
The function of the current healthcare system is not to provide quality care to all in a cost-effective way. The function of the current system is to make billions of dollars in profits for the insurance companies and the drug companies.
So how about that, John Kingsdale? What do you say to the senator there? He says that the private insurance model is sort of inherently corrupt because people are out for profit and not for good health care.
Well, I do think there's an issue of trust with insurers, with doctors, with hospitals and pharmaceutical companies. And every system, whether it's publicly, pure public, or private for-profit, private nonprofit, has its advantages and disadvantages. I don't think, for example, we'd want to see all hospitals run by government or all pharmaceutical companies run by government because we value some of the innovation and, frankly, entrepreneurship in the private sector. I do think that insurance is one where there's so much of an issue of trust that there needs to be very strict government sort of framing of the market and oversight. We have that in Massachusetts. And I think that part of protecting and building on the Affordable Care Act is to take what has been a pretty strong intervention into the least functional part of the market, the individual non-employer part of the market, and to strengthen that and make sure that there's strong consumer protection built into the oversight of that. As I say, am I in love with insurance companies? No. Would Medicare for All be a disaster if we could get there? No. It has lots of attractive features to it. But the disruption of getting from here to there is, I think people don't appreciate. You know, not only is it putting $2 trillion or more a year in from the private sector into federal taxes, which will create all sorts of winners and losers, very disruptive, it means taking some 16 million jobs and pretty much cutting the funding available for them. Because if you're going to fund through taxes a much more generous benefit package, as Senator Sanders has proposed, you're going to have to cut the payment rates for those services.
Yeah, let me just drill down on that a little bit, right? Because one of the advantages that people like who are in Medicare right now is that they pay less, but also Medicare reimburses less to those hospitals for care than private insurers typically do. So if everybody is basically under Medicare, that could be less money in the coffers of the hospitals and what happens to them. And you have some other concerns as well as I'm reading through your story. And one is about the bottleneck, potential for a bottleneck of health care for folks. In other words, you're going to bring a lot of new people, 20, maybe 30 million more people onto the insurance rolls. That's a good thing, but maybe that means longer wait times for people. What are you worried about there?
It's not just bringing on another 20 million. And as you say, if we give Medicare to undocumented aliens, it's 30 million. It's also making basically free all sorts of services for which there is some cost sharing now. And so I think we're going to see an increased demand. I mean,
so people would just use it more, in other words.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And some of that's legitimate and reasonable and desirable, some less so. But whether it's good or bad in and of itself, it's going to increase the demand on what is already in short supply, whether it's primary care or mental health and substance abuse caretakers or home care, whatever. It's going to increase that demand significantly, which maybe leads to a fairer way of rationing. I'm not saying there isn't economic rationing now. The problem is you're going to get losers and winners. You're going to get a lot of people who say, gee, we got to Medicare for All, and now I can't see my doctor. And that's going to create a backlash. And that potential of that is what opponents of just basic liberal reform are going to seize on in the name of undoing all the progress we've already made.
You know that some other folks would argue that there are already winners and losers within the healthcare system. I mean that, you know, certainly drug companies would be one of the big winners right now. They're under a lot of scrutiny from the president. And actually, this is one of those few bipartisan issues right now. I mean, in other words, what about that argument that, look, maybe the winners and losers just take a different form, but is it really all that different in the big picture?
Well, here's where I think you have to look at quantity, I mean, in a serious way. When we're talking about tax revenues of $3.3 trillion a year, federal tax revenues, and adding $2 to $3 trillion more to fund Medicare for All in a system which Medicare Trust Fund is supposed to go bankrupt in about 6 years just as it is. And this would not only improve Medicare for seniors, but much more generous for everybody. You're talking about huge levels of disruption, tens of millions of people who will end up paying more in taxes than they currently pay or think they pay in premiums. So it's not just some people on the margin being disadvantaged. It is literally tens of millions of voters thinking, boy, I just got screwed in this deal. And that is a recipe for backlash, for revolt. So I would say if I was thinking seriously about how to get to Medicare for All, I would be focusing on how do I narrow the gap between where we are now and where I would ultimately want to get to. How do I make that far less disruptive? And
so,
I think there are a number of steps we could take.
Yeah, this is the last thing. I mean, so then what do you propose in the short term then? Do you introduce a public option, which a lot of folks wanted in the ACA originally,
right,
didn't get it? Is that the sort of, you know, step toward a future Medicare for All?
Well, actually, I think Nancy Pelosi, the adult in the room in the House, is working on a number of reforms that would move in that direction. And that's a key one. In fact, think about who's paying in the individual market. It's really federal taxpayers. This is highly subsidized coverage. Why shouldn't those health plans have the same Medicare rates that Medicare now enjoys? Let's bring down the cost and the premiums that way.
That's John Kingsdale. He's a professor at the Boston University School of Public Health and the founding executive director of the Commonwealth Health Insurance Connector Authority, which helped make health insurance universally available in Massachusetts. John, thanks a lot for your time today.
Thank you, Cal.
Next week, we'll speak with a physician who supports Medicare for All. But in the short term, stay with us. There's more ahead. We're talking about how the NFL should handle Patriots owner Robert Kraft. And we'll take your calls. I'm Callum Borchers. This is Radio Boston.
Wait a second.
Don't hit the skip button.
I mean, we know you do it.
We just wanted to take a second here because you already know how to download a podcast.
But you might have a question about some of the other technology you use. And we think we can help.
WBUR is working on a new show, and we're here to answer your tech questions, whether it's hardware-related,
software-related, social, even ethical.
Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and give us a call. Leave a message, 617-917-4717.
Give it a try, 617-917-4717.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Callum Borchers. NFL owners are gathering in Miami today and tomorrow for the league's spring meeting. Topics include possible rule changes and locations of future NFL drafts. Another item on the league's agenda, whether it comes up at the meeting or not, is how to handle Patriots owner Robert Kraft, who was charged with soliciting prostitution. A Florida judge ruled last week that surveillance video allegedly showing Kraft in the act cannot be used in court. Prosecutors are appealing, but some legal analysts say the decision is a crippling blow to the case against Kraft. Whatever the outcome in court, Kraft will have to stand trial in the judgment of the NFL. The league is pledged to, quote, take appropriate action under its personal conduct policy. But what will that look like? And will it be enough? Joining us now to discuss is WBUR sports and society reporter Shira Springer. Hey there, Shira.
Hello.
Also with us on the phone is Boston Globe sports columnist and associate editor Dan Shaughnessy. Hi, Dan.
Hello.
And listeners, we'd like to hear from you as well. How do you think the NFL should handle the Robert Kraft case? And will the league's actions be holding Kraft accountable or salvaging its own reputation? You can call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK or tweet us at Radio Boston. All right, Dan Shaughnessy, let me begin with you. What is at stake here for the NFL in this decision on Robert Kraft?
Well, they've had a track record in the recent years of inconsistent punishments doled out to primarily players, and there is a conduct policy, and they're going to have to make a decision. The commissioner will have to make a decision as to what to do about Bob Kraft here, and I think that no matter what he does, he'll come under an avalanche of criticism either way. If he goes very light on Bob Kraft, you certainly believe that in this climate it's not the time to do that and that he should be held to a higher standard. If he comes down heavy, Patriot Nation will rally around the owner the way they always do and claim that they're being targeted and singled out and unfairly punished for something that was not proven in court.
Yeah, sure. I mean, to Dan's point, this would seem to be a no-win
situation. We have a lot
situation.
Of practice in these parts of rallying around, members of the Patriots.
Spygate, Deflategate.
Exactly. When, fans feel that the justice handed out by the quote-unquote justice handed out by the league is unfair.
Dan, can the league just let this thing fizzle away altogether, though? Is that an option on the table? I mean, we're thinking about whether there'll be a fine or perhaps a suspension or something like that. But perhaps they could just say, look, if the charges are ultimately dropped, which is a possible scenario here, maybe the league just walks away from the issue entirely.
Well, the charges being dropped is a likely scenario, given the high-powered attorneys and the loopholes and all the high-financed tax that they've taken down to Florida. But commissioners rule independent of that, and there's multiple instances of players being punished when it was not adjudicated against them. And if an owner gets away with this, and after players have been punished for conduct unbecoming of the NFL, there'll certainly be a double standard brought forth there by the Players Association, And I got to think that, you know, they have to worry about this video surfacing. It happened with Ray Rice. Ray Rice, you know, this is a much worse transgression. You know, he punched his girlfriend in an elevator, and the sanctions were relatively light. The video came out subsequent to that, and then you look really bad. And Goodell has to be mindful that if he goes light or doesn't do anything here, and then the video comes out, in the court of public opinion, that's going to look bad for the league.
So just a reminder on the Ray Rice episode. He was the Baltimore Ravens star running back who was initially suspended only 2 games for what the league knew to be an assault and battery. And then later, a website obtained elevator footage that actually showed the act, and the public outrage grew so loud that the league suspended him indefinitely. He's never played again. But Shira, that was a case where the footage really seemed to be a big turning point in the public eye and the league's position on crimes against women. And yet, in the aftermath of that, the implementation has been spotty. I'm thinking about the Giants punter Josh Brown, for example. One game, Kareem Hunt. Exactly. The list goes on.
Exactly. Just every season, it seems like there's a case where the NFL either didn't pursue the video evidence strong enough, didn't pursue an investigation strong enough against a player, and then they're sort of caught flat-footed and having to react with a punishment when more evidence trickles out. And I think Dan is exactly right. The NFL does have to worry about this video somehow surfacing down the line. And they really can't afford not to act. They have to do something. And I think even in the NFL offices, they realize that because it's such an image-conscious league. It's a league that's so concerned about optics and how things appear. And if there's disproportionate punishment, if players are punished much more harshly than owners, particularly prominent, powerful owners, it's a really bad look that the league can't afford. So if anything is guiding them in a weird way, it may not be the alleged crime or, you know, what's all trickled out in the legal proceedings. It may be a concern about the image and, as they say in the NFL, protecting the shield.
We're talking about what the NFL should do about prostitution charges against Robert Kraft with our own Shira Springer and the Boston Globe's Dan Shaughnessy. And we'd like you to join us as well. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Pat is calling from Watertown. What do you think, Pat?
It's hard for me to take any action the NFL takes against Kraft seriously, and I'm in no way defending Kraft, given not just everything that your two guests just said, but also the fact that the way they treat their cheerleaders, as has been documented over and over again, as independent contractors and woefully mistreating the women that already are on their payrolls, not to mention these women involved with players. Thank you.
How about that, Shira Springer?
Pat saying there's a broader issue here. Excellent, excellent point, because this is a much bigger issue. I mean, Kraft is one case. Kareem Hunt is one case. Ray Rice is one case. But there is a much bigger issue here, and that is the NFL and its treatment of women, its respect for women, how it punishes the people who are employed by the league or who own teams when they don't treat women respectfully, when they, assault women, harass women, whatever the case may be, don't treat women fairly in the case of the cheerleaders. Yeah, I think Pat has hit on a really key point here, which is the NFL has to consider the bigger picture in terms of women and the way the NFL treats women or is perceived to be treating women.
But Dan Shaughnessy, can you kind of elaborate on the competing interests that the league has that you were touching on earlier? I mean, they've got this image problem that Shira is talking about. They are widely seen as not taking issues serious enough when it comes to violence against women. So if they come down hard on Kraft, perhaps they address that concern. But then there's also the perception among Patriots Nation that, we're targets, right? That the league comes after us, whether it's, hitting Tom Brady with 4 games for Deflategate or fining Bill Belichick $1 million for Spygate.
Right. And I think that what's going to be you have to be careful not to confuse the issues that if the case is dismissed, he is not exonerated in terms of this doesn't establish that he wasn't there, that this didn't happen. He's worked hard to suppress video, which would certainly absolve him of all guilt if the video were not damning, and they don't want that to come out. He has apologized publicly. We're not sure for what, since he said he did nothing illegal, but it's on record here that this happened. Everybody knows this happened. So for the league to do nothing, even in the wake of the court not doing anything, I think that's going to be a hard thing to do. And don't forget, when the Black Sox threw the World Series in 1919, they were exonerated by the courts in Illinois. They were not found guilty. And then the commissioner of baseball said, well, that's all nice, but you're all suspended for life. You can never play baseball again.
Yeah.
Now, these transgressions certainly aren't the same, but the commissioner does not have to go along with what the courts do.
I like you invoking Judge Kennesaw Mountain Landis, Dan, in the Black Sox scandal. Is Roger Goodell the new – he doesn't strike me as a Kennesaw Mountain Landis type of character, but
no.
But maybe I'm wrong. I mean, it seems like back then in 1919, the commissioner had a very specific agenda, but maybe Goodell does too. I think it's important also just to remember, you know, kind of what jurisdiction, so to speak, Goodell has in all of this. This falls under not a legal statute, but what the league has in place, which is the personal conduct policy, and that basically states that, you know, whether it's an owner, a player, a league employee, members of the team staff, coaches, they must refrain from conduct detrimental to the integrity of and public confidence in the NFL. And that's a very vague sort of policy they have in place. And it gives, obviously, as we've seen with Patriots cases in the past, it gives Goodell a lot of latitude when it comes to punishment and the types of things he punishes, independent of what happens in the legal system.
Yeah, a lot of discretion there. So we're inviting all of you to play commissioner for, you know, this hour, if you'd like. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. If you'd like to say what you would do if you were in Commissioner Goodell's situation. Galen is in Newton. Galen, what do you think?
Thanks for taking my call. It's a real pleasure and privilege. It seems like the NFL had in the past with the concussion controversy an opportunity to really show that it could stand on a strong moral ground. And given what seems like the evidence against Kraft, regardless of what the court finds, I would hope that the NFL takes some sort of action to show that owners, though they might have a lot of money, are held to account in a similar way that normal people might be. And I'd love to hear what your guests have to say about whether they think that will actually happen. And if it doesn't, what the backlash might or might not be from fans and advertisers.
Galen, thanks for the call there. So how about that, Dan Shaughnessy? I mean, there's a smaller sample size with the owners, obviously. You know, we think back to 2014, for example. We did see some discipline against the Colts owner, James Irsay, but he had pleaded guilty to driving while intoxicated.
That was, a misdemeanor while driving? Yeah.
But that's a case where there was a conviction in court followed by a punishment by the league.
It was a hefty punishment, too. You know, six-game suspension and $500,000 fine. I mean, that, you know, and he couldn't be near the team or near, you know, the facility for the duration of that suspension. I mean, you know, for a misdemeanor,
sure,
that seemed like a pretty hefty punishment.
But Dan, to Galen's point there, he's wondering whether the same standard will be applied to an owner like Robert Kraft that we see sometimes applied to players where maybe they aren't convicted of anything in court, but they're still punished by the league.
Yeah, I think something's coming Bob's way on this because, you know, and that's why I'm not really clear about what the strategy was in Florida to spend so much money and go so hard at a misdemeanor. Because he's worried about his status in the NFL, his Hall of Fame potential down the road, and those things, this court case does not make those things go away for him, unfortunately for him. And I just think that ultimately the commissioner is going to have to do something here, and I think the Kraft camp at this point expects that. I think they know something's coming down. And again, what does it matter if an owner gets suspended? I mean, it's not like he's the quarterback or the tight end. He's not affecting games. It means he can't, you know, wave from the box and have everybody kiss his ring and be in the Klieg lights, you know, on CBS on Sunday when they raise the banner. So it doesn't really affect anything except his status in the sport, his status in the Hall of Fame, which he's something he desperately wants. This comes along at a bad time regarding that candidacy.
Yeah, I also think, though, in some ways, the worst thing to happen to Kraft has sort of already happened, and that's the public embarrassment and having to go through this, having to have his name out there in association with prostitution, you know, the fact that there may be a videotape out there, you know, with evidence, you know, that he doesn't want seen. I mean, all of this stuff that's coming out, I think for him, the personal embarrassment, and you talk about, you know, it hurts his status, it hurts his Hall of Fame candidacy, I think that all factors into, obviously, a punishment for Kraft. But I think in some ways, even if he is suspended 3, 4, 5, 6 games, whatever the case may be, and fined, I think in many ways he's already weathered the worst punishment, and that's the public embarrassment of this whole situation dragging on and on and on.
Dan Shaughnessy, how about that Hall of Fame? I think that's something that some fans have been wondering. Is there a real risk there to him now?
And again, to Shearer's point, you know, I mean, having weathered the thing, but he has, with his actions, he has made this thing drag on and on and on. This happened February 22nd when it was announced, and we are now 3 months later, and we're still talking about it. We're doing a whole show on it here, and it's in the papers every day, and now this is going to come up with the punishment. But if he had just kind of done what most guys do in this case, is just said, yeah, sorry, I won't do that again, but that's not the Patriot way, that's not the Kraft way. It's always, you know, accuse, you know, deny, deny, accuse, that sort of thing. And they've pushed very hard toward the prosecutors down there, and I think that just enhances the chances of that video coming out, which is not going to be a good thing for them.
Yeah, this is the team of Deflategate Report and Context.com, right?
Yeah.
So let's take a few more calls. Lindsay is in Newton. Lindsay, what do you think?
I'm just curious about Gillette's stand on things and how they come into play. I know that last year they put out a new commercial video in response to the Me Too movement asking, is this really the best a man can get? And being the owners of the stadium, just where they take a stand or whether or not they do at all.
Lindsay, thanks for the ring. Just to clarify, they're not the owner of the stadium, but they are the title sponsor.
Yeah,
it is Gillette Stadium.
Yeah.
And so to that point, Shira, it appears, at least in the immediate aftermath, first few months, that corporate sponsors are sticking by the Patriots. That seems to be one of the storms that Kraft has weathered, as you put
it. Yeah, I mean, I think everybody is waiting, and that includes the league and sponsors and corporations and businesses affiliated with the Patriots, whether their name is on the stadium or not, to see how things play out. I mean, I don't think anyone, I mean, when news first broke, I mean, there was a lot of, you know, reporting about human trafficking and so on and so forth. And you know, there was this big storm of coverage. And then as things have gone on, you know, there have been questions thrown into, you know, is it this, is it that? And so I think the prudent tact by those, you know, the corporate folks is to wait and see what happens, just in, you know, in much the same way the NFL is waiting to see what happens on the legal side before they act.
Eileen is in Salem. Eileen, what do you think?
I think that, you know, there is definitely rules in place. The commissioner has a job to do, and, you know, the owners, the players, everyone involved with the NFL knows how they're supposed to behave before they even are, you know, contracted or whatever. And Robert Kraft should have thought of what he was doing, you know, before he decided to do inappropriate things. And just, you know, if he would have thought, oh, it's going to cost me the Hall of Fame, whatever, then guess what? You screwed up, buddy. So you need to, you know, deal with what's coming. Feel the wrath.
Eileen, thanks for the ring. Let's try to get in one more. Dave is in Methuen. What do you think, Dave?
I disagree. I think that the NFL shouldn't be involved in the legal matters. We have a legal system that addresses these issues, and they determine the punishments. Now, by allowing corporations into your personal life or legal matters, it's a double jeopardy. You're going to get punished twice? Come on. That's not fair. It's not right. And where does the line get crossed? Where do we say, oh, that's enough, or yeah, you can do this, no, you can't do that? Come on. It's a road that I don't think we want to travel as a society, because then your corporation becomes your judge, jury, and executioner.
Got it, Dave. Thank you for the call. So, Shira, I mean, I guess I understand Dave's point on some level there, but that would be such a departure from precedent, right? I mean, the league has for a long time said that it has the authority to – this is collectively bargained, in
yes.
fact, that it has
yes.
the authority to mete out punishment regardless of what the legal system does. They
yeah.
couldn't walk away from that now, could they?
Exactly. I mean, this is a horse out of the barn scenario, which is they've done it. They've been there. Again, we can reference the personal conduct policy. That's in there. It's collectively bargained. This is the policy. This is, you know, the NFL believes it has and it does, you know, have the right to punish league employees, coaches, players, et cetera, owners that they feel are not representing their business interests well, their league well. I mean, that's the way it's been and that's the way it will continue to be. Now, on the separately from, like, I think he was talking separately, corporations like Gillette, which was a separate question. Yeah, it is interesting. I mean, do you – if – the legal case had proceeded along a different track, and if there was, you know, it looked like it was going to go forward and perhaps, you know, lead to some sort of guilty verdict down the line, you know, do corporations who are really team sponsors have a responsibility to say something, do something, withdraw support potentially? That's a bigger question and something I think each corporation decides individually.
Dan Shaughnessy, in our final few seconds, what are the chances that Robert Kraft and the league are kind of hammering out some kind of negotiation right now? I mean, we had a big, long appeals process with Deflategate. It'd be nice to avoid that this time.
I don't know about any kind of a deal being struck between the commissioner and the owner of the Patriots in this one. I think that the commissioner's got to rule independently. He's probably polling the other owners. And a lot of those guys are kind of scared about this because they know their own closets have skeletons and they don't want to maybe come down too hard on one of their peers. But as we've referenced before, you know, Bob Kraft is a member of a club. It's a franchise. They go by the rules. Your employer can do something to you independent of what the courts do. That's part of being employed by someone, or in this case, being a franchise owner, part of a club. So they're independent, and we're going to find out at some point between now and the start of the season what the commissioner is going to do about this.
That's Boston Globe sports columnist and associate editor Dan Shaughnessy. Dan, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, guys.
Also, our thanks to WBUR's sports and society reporter, Shira Springer.
Thank you.
That's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Callum Borchers. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.
Wait, don't go yet.
Because you already know how to download a podcast.
But if you have any other tech or life question, maybe we can help you. WBUR is working on a new show, and we need your tech questions.
Or maybe your parents' questions. Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and leave a message. 617-917-4717.
Yes, we know. How quaint. A phone call. But give it a try. 617-917-4717.